Do you have any questions about the oral argument procedures?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. With that, I believe we can begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Kathy Gowdy, 28436, alternate defense counsel for Mr. Gary Williams in this case. And as I start out on this case, I think it's important to understand that what he was charged with in this case was only receipt of stolen goods. That is essential because it goes to why it was error and reversible error to let in all of the evidence from other burglaries. It does not show modus or operandi or common scheme to have burgled a building if what you're charged with is receipt of stolen goods. Possessing a stolen plasma TV did not justify the admission of the 404B of actual burglaries.
Also, doesn't it logically make more probable his knowledge that the plasma TV was stolen?
It was not offered for intent. It was offered for commonality of scheme. That was the ruling the judge found. The prosecution, when it tendered the offer on the burglaries only for the 404B, listed the whole litany that you can put in for that. It was not specific. It did not do a precise hypothesis as required by the cases of Colorado.
That wasn't the issue that you pursued on appeal, I believe, though, the precise hypothesis. Wasn't intent one of the purposes listed in the instruction for which the jury could have considered the evidence?
The jury instruction, I thought the ruling of the court was that it was offered for the limited purpose of commonality of scheme. And that was what I looked at.
What was the instruction given to the jury?
That I do not have in front of me, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Let me ask you a question, though. As you started to say, the burglaries could not, tend to show that they received or retained stolen property. Can you prove that someone who is found in possession with stolen property, can you prove that offense by showing they were the thief himself or herself?
I don't believe so, because that's not one of the elements of the crime.
Well,
the crime itself, the statute is stated, says that you received from another knowing that it was stolen. There wasn't any proof of that in the trial in this case. They tried the wrong charge. If they wanted to prove as burglary, they didn't charge it correctly. And why they didn't?
And in closing, they said they didn't want to prove burglary. In closing argument, the prosecution said, "We're not here. We can't prove burglary." But the common thing from the rest of all these other incidents are that in each instance he had retained stolen property.
It was also that he had committed burglaries, and that's propensity. And that's exactly what 404B is designed not to do. It's ancillary to what the elements of this crime are. It is not ancillary in and of itself, so it goes through the inadmissibility test of a 404B. 404B presumes inadmissibility unless they meet certain standards. Now, while it has gotten easier and easier, it seems, to get 404B in by stretching the standards, in this particular case, it was not essential to any of the elements of receipt of stolen goods, which is what he was charged with. And that argument goes specifically to the other burglaries. And originally, as you recall, first they brought in six cases, I believe, and joined them. Then they separated, and then they had three. And so the analysis for the 404B at the original motion does change, and it had to under the severance. The wide one, it was important to bring them all together and then sever them because it was setting 8 to 10 day jury trials because you're trying the 404B and ignoring the issue. And the elements of this issue was knowingly received stolen goods.
In the posture of the case changed, did the defense renew their objection to this evidence?
They renewed their objection throughout the trial, Your Honor. They did. The other issue in the 404B was the admission of uncharged 404B, allowing the people to elicit testimony about the sexual relations between Mr. Williams and a 16-year-old before the jury. That clearly is not relevant to any of the issues in receipt of stolen goods. And in fact, probably, if it had been the other way around, would not have been admissible under Rape Shield, but that's not in my brief. But it's that strong an issue, and it's that improper, and it brought in a whole range of other impermissible factors that should not have been brought into this case. And it also tied in with the inconsistency then with the ruling that there was no marital privilege between the 16-year-old and Mr. Williams. The judge had found there was no consummation and then allowed testimony of sexual relations. If there, it's an unfair bias, it is an unfair decision, in which case they should have allowed.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Counsel, was there evidence admitted of sexual relations after January 23rd?
There was. I put it in my reply brief, I believe, the specifics. She, in fact, I think had stayed there the night before. She went around with the police to start showing where the various burgled places were. And that was, I believe, on February 2nd that there was testimony that they had indeed. And ironic as it is, and as unpleasant it is to raise this, there is no requirement for common law that you be have fidelity to your wife.
About evidence of cohabitation, was there any?
There was evidence she stayed over. There was evidence that she slept with him.
Is that cohabitation, counsel?
It can be.
Under what authority?
The authority of the case is stated in both the people's and my briefs. She stayed there. She said she was. And the other thing you have to look at in the evidence in this case is that there's the period of 6 months where she wanted to be married to him. She wears a wedding ring. She tells everybody she's married to him. She signs credit card slips as Mrs. Williams. She does all of this after he's arrested and states they cohabitate. Then she meets another man in September. She's 16 and a half. He's facing a lot of time, and she doesn't want to be married anymore. That isn't how the statutes of Colorado and common law address, you know, common law marriage. It isn't as long as you want it.
Isn't that interpreting one interpretation of the facts? Isn't there a conflicting set of facts that would lend itself to a different interpretation, counsel?
Which conflicting set of facts do you mean, Your Honor?
The conflicting set of facts where she, if believed, said they were never married. If she did not hold herself out to be married until she went along with his plan after he got arrested.
Yes, all of those facts are there. All of those happened after September, after the first 6 month period where she wanted to be married. There was no testimony that she said she wasn't married to him during the period she was happy about it.
Oh, right. Isn't that of when she said that? She testified at trial, though, that they were never married, didn't she?
She did.
So if there's conflicting evidence, what basis do we have to interfere with the trial judge's determination?
It was an abuse of discretion under the common law statute of under the common law of Colorado. You hold yourself out for marriage for 6 months, you get a divorce. You don't say, I wasn't really married, I was only doing it then. It would completely upend, I believe, the common law marriage tradition we have that people suddenly are allowed to back out. And it also came out at trial that she was never received charges, although she participated by her own testimony in these burglaries. In fact, they told her right up front, you will not be charged if you talk about this and cooperate. But she still maintained she was married to him even after that cooperation agreement, because that was all in February. It's in September of 2003 that she meets another guy where she's working, and then she doesn't want to be Mrs. Williams anymore. And that is the difference in this and how the judge ruled, and it wasn't abuse of discretion on that judge's part. He misapplied the standard of being common law married. And so it is reversible on that, because the statements she made should have been protected under marital privilege.
Just the statements. Nothing about her observations of what she may or may not have seen the defendant do.
They never went into the actual effect limits of the privilege.
I'm asking you, just the statements.
Well, it's not in the record, Your Honor, because he ruled there wasn't a common law, so it's not in the record. It would have to be remanded to determine what the extent of the privilege was for a marriage. So it isn't in the record for me to guess on that. So far what we have is a case of receipt of stolen goods in which the primary evidence was burglaries, elements of burglary. We have a marital privilege that was an abuse of discretion, and then it winds up without even a minimus. And this court does have the authority to remand to require a minimus with credit time served. It hasn't been done yet. But this court also has facing it.
Let me ask you, counsel, about that minimus. Did the trial court have jurisdiction to issue a minimus after the notice of appeal had been filed in this case?
I don't know, Your Honor, but it's that they have in other cases I have seen. Because the minimus is the sentencing document that goes to DOC. It drives everything. And without a minimus, we just have an oral transcript. If he had not appealed, they'd have no terms. Plus, they did not give him credit for time served, which under the statute...
Did you raise that as an issue on appeal? They did not give him credit for time served?
I did, Your Honor.
Where?
In my opening brief.
Where? Is it a separate argument supported by any authority? Any citations to the record? You may have made the statement. Did you make an argument or develop an argument about this?
Not under a specific heading, no, Your Honor. But I did raise it in my brief, and I did discuss it. This one had so much that they have to sort of merge issues to meet your page limits to get it all compressed into one document. But yes, I did raise it. Do you need the page number, Your Honor?
It's 21.
Thank you. And I also cited the statute in that for the credit for time served, which is, I believe, 18.1.3405. So I did put in authority as well, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay. And that takes us, as I'm starting to run out of time, to the final argument that if this court does remand for minimus, this court has the power to set aside the habitual finding so that the minimus is correct, even if you do not reverse the conviction, to the only the time that he should get for receipt of stolen goods. The habitual process was incorrect in this. They did not have the experts that the cases that the people have cited used to prove identity. And as the court is aware, identity is the issue in a habitual case. It starts to go into the issue of pen pals. Melendez-Diaz has said that if it's an elemental issue, there is a right of confrontation. Everything in a pen pal is testimonial. It is an affidavit, a solemn declaration. It is testimonial by nature. It is requested by the district attorney solely for the purpose of prosecution. And it assembles, as it says in several of the cases, documents that they put together from DOC. And yet there was no representative DOC there to explain the documents. The court allowed hearsay testimony that initials of somebody else were on a document as part of the authenticity. The court allowed testimony from a person who is not certified in fingerprints who examined the fingerprints. They allowed a paralegal who did not know the DOC policies and procedures to testify hearsay that a DOC number, she's never seen one that was different from a person. But that is not the source, and that is not the right of confrontation. It should have been someone who knew, had personal knowledge, because when you're challenging identity, that's the confrontation that would have occurred. Was this the same Gary Williams as the person cited there? Unlike several of the cases, the testimony didn't go to the photograph of a picture of Gary Williams holding his number, or any of the things that are in the cases that I cited in my brief. Those where they found there was appropriate foundation laid. This habitual trial, which is a trial with a verdict beyond a reasonable doubt for each of the elements caused, was not proven by anything except hearsay evidence and must be reversed for the habitual sentencing portion alone. And if the court has no question, I would like to reserve my remaining 1 minute and 50 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. Your Honors, I really don't have anything in addition to add to my briefs. I would be happy to answer any questions, and I'd also like to answer a few questions that were posed to opposing counsel. I believe Your Honor asked if this was offered for intent, and not only was the prosecution's, there were several opportunities the prosecution to state the purpose for which the 404B evidence was introduced, both in the written motion and several times during the hearing, and every time they referenced intent, knowledge, common plan, and scheme. And these are often interrelated. A common plan and scheme can demonstrate intent, can demonstrate knowledge.
You know if the instruction included intent?
Instruction did include intent. It said for the limited purpose to show common plan, scheme, design, identity, modus operandi, and intent. So intent clearly was at issue here, or clearly was offered for the purpose of this 404B.
Counsel, how is it relevant to demonstrate identity?
I don't think it was. I'm not sure why they included that one, because I don't think it was, looking at the prosecution's offer, I don't think it was offered. I'm sorry. At one point, relates to identity and the defendant's knowledge and ability to carry out the offenses. I think that's a tendency sometimes when you're making an argument to discuss there's so many purposes. To be candid, I don't think it was offered to show identity. I don't think his person, his identity as the person who possessed the item was in dispute. So I would, to be candid, I would agree that it's not, but I don't.
Okay, I thank you for that candid admission. And we know what happens is that very often when these things are offered, the prosecutor just gives a long, the usual laundry list of potential reasons. And I guess if we accept your view that this evidence was probative on the issue of intent, we also have to accept that it was had some danger of being unfairly prejudicial, because it showed that there were these burglaries. And I guess I wonder how we can credit as a proper exercise of the court's discretion the 403 balancing that seems to be premised on an erroneous view of logical relevance. I mean, if the court is thinking that it's also relevant for identity.
Well, I think, I mean, what you, it looks like what you have here is you had the prosecution including identity, and the prosecution didn't just list this in its motion. There was a lengthy discussion. The prosecution explained not only reference these words, identity, intent, motive, that kind of thing, but explain it all. And so what likely happened is when the instruction was given, they kind of referenced what the prosecution had stated and included it. But because identity really wasn't a disputed issue in this case, I think the fact that it may have been erroneously included in the issue, I mean, in the instruction, doesn't cause him any prejudice whatsoever. I mean, if identity was a disputed issue and it wasn't relevant for identity, I think that would be a problem. But I think here, identity certainly wasn't an issue. And so the fact that it was included in the instruction was likely an oversight. And I don't think that certainly identity was a big part of the court's 403 analysis either. I think it was pretty clear that they were focusing on the fact that his commission of these burglaries demonstrated a common plan and scheme, which
what?
To commit burglaries and obtain stolen items.
So are you saying he was involved in this burglary as well?
Well, I think what you often have to do with 404B analysis is you have to take several steps. You have inferences that you obtain from certain evidence. In this case, the fact that he committed two burglaries, very similar to the burglary in this case, shows a common plan and scheme, modus operandi. That in turn demonstrated his intent to permanently deprive the owner of the property and his knowledge that the item was stolen. Taking the next step, how does it show that? Well, there's several different ways. There's one way in which you can infer, as the prosecution certainly did not concede that he was not the burglar in the Univans burglary. So if he was the burglar in that, certainly he would have knowledge that the item was stolen. And to answer your earlier question, while you certainly can't be convicted of being the thief and also theft by receiving, the prosecution is entitled to present alternate theories, and the prosecution is simply required to elect before.
Why doesn't that just simply, you know, allow the jury to speculate that, okay, even though the prosecution is saying we can't prove he's committed the burglary, you can still consider that, of course, he committed this burglary, and that's why you ought to convict him, not of the charged offense, but of the receiving stolen property?
Well, because the prosecution is allowed to argue inferences from that evidence. And that's what they did. They said, we don't have to decide whether he committed this burglary in this case. He has a common plan and scheme of committing burglaries. And the fact that he does this makes it more likely that this stolen item...
Did the prosecution say the common plan scheme is to commit burglaries or to retain stolen property?
Both.
The prosecution did say both?
I believe they, I mean, they
did the prosecution argue that to the jury as well?
They did not directly argue to the jury he committed this burglary. I think they skirted around it, and I just read that closing argument this morning. They skirted around it, but I think there was the inference is that he's committing these burglaries, and so he has a practice then of obtaining stolen items. And that makes it more likely, therefore, that regardless of whether he stole the television in this place or committed the burglary in this place, he knew that it was stolen. And I think there's another theory, and they did rely a lot on this idea that he committed these burglaries, or at least one of them, the 404B one, with Richard Vaughn. And there was a lot of evidence that Richard Vaughn was likely involved in this Univance burglary. And so that's another connection between these burglaries and the burglary that yielded the stolen television in this case.
That may be true, but what's the connection between SG's burglary and stolen items in this case?
Because they're all similar, it makes it more likely that he was involved in the second burglary, the burglary at the Oracle E-College. Frankly, it makes it more likely that he committed the burglary in this case. Although he was not charged with it. But if the jury were to infer from the evidence that he was involved in the burglary somehow, regardless of whether the prosecution can prove it, it makes it more likely that he knew that the television was stolen. And it makes it certainly more likely that he possessed that item with the intent to permanently deprive, that it wasn't something that was just given to him.
So you don't have to find that he's involved in the burglary. You can infer he's involved in the burglary. He's not charged with being involved in the burglary, but that's not propensity evidence?
Well, I think propensity evidence is not prohibited under 404B. Bad character evidence is prohibited under 404B. A common plan and scheme, and this is something that I've never quite understood, the repeated defense argument that propensity evidence is prohibited. Propensity evidence is common plan and scheme. What's prohibited by 404B is saying he has a propensity to commit a certain crime and therefore he has a bad character, and because he has a bad character, he therefore likely committed this crime. That's the type of propensity evidence, the rationale that's not allowed. That wasn't even suggested here. Yes, they argue that he had a practice of committing burglaries in this manner, and he had a practice of retaining the stolen items from these burglaries in his home. And so,
isn't that the more probative point? That these may have been similar burglaries, but really the probative point is that in each one of them, he ends up with something stolen?
Yes, exactly.
As opposed to he's the one who's actually committing the burglaries?
Right, and I think that's why they argued. They said you don't need to decide. We're not here to decide whether he committed this burglary. He has a habit of obtaining stolen items. In these other cases, he committed the burglary himself. In this case, we don't know. But he has a practice, he has a propensity, if you call it. Again, I don't have a problem with that word propensity as long as it's not related to bad character. And he has a common plan and scheme of obtaining these stolen items. And that goes to not only, again, his knowledge that the item was stolen, but also his intent to permanently deprive. And I think that's consistent with what the prosecution argued in this case. With regard, unless there's any further questions on the 404B, I think I tried to answer the questions that you asked of counsel. I did note specifically with regard to whether there was an objection following the severance, based on the dates, because we have the electronic transcripts, it looked like there may have been an objection to the evidence at trial as well, which would be then, therefore, after the severance. With regard to the spousal privilege, the only comment I'd like to make is this holding out aspect of it is certainly important, this holding yourselves out as a married couple. But if you look at the language of Lucero that I cited in my brief that discusses this issue, there has to be a mutual agreement and consent followed by holding out as a married couple. We have direct testimony in this case that there was never any mutual agreement and consent. The trial court was certainly entitled to rely on her testimony, SG's testimony, that there was never any mutual agreement or consent for her to be married. And that's even putting aside the credibility issues as to the holding out after he was arrested. So not only that, but we have no evidence of cohabitation or intimate relations whatsoever after his the June 20th date.
January 20th. Opposing counsel has suggested that staying over and sleeping with the defendant constitutes cohabitation. Is that correct?
That occurred after January 20th. If I reread the entire transcript of all of the testimony and spousal privilege, I found absolutely no evidence of cohabitation or intimate relations after January 20th. In fact, in the reply brief, the defendant cites a certain portion of the record to suggest that the trial court, that there was evidence of intimate relations after January 20th. That citation simply refers to a question by counsel. It says, is it possible you told, to SG, is it possible you told him you were married about March of 2003? And she's referring to her comments to the officers. That didn't have anything to do with intimate relations. And frankly, there is just absolutely none. And so cohabitation, as the courts have recognized, is required. There's absolutely no evidence they cohabitated at any time other than brief overnight stays, which are certainly consistent with more of a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, which she suggested they had, than with a married relationship. Does this court have any further questions regard to any of the issues?
One quick question. How would you respond, how do you respond to your colleague's argument here that the defendant's right of confrontation was abridged during the habitual criminal proceedings?
Well, I think, first of all, it wasn't raised, so it's subject to plain error review, and I believe the case I cited, it was related to the pen packs. The case I cited has held that pen packs are not testimonial for purposes of confrontation.
You concede that there is a right of confrontation in habitual criminal determinations?
I have not researched that issue, and I'm not very familiar with the full, I mean, obviously Crawford has yielded a substantial amount of litigation, and I'm not familiar with that, so I'm not, don't feel comfortable agreeing. Although I do recognize that habitual criminal counts have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, they do not have to be proved to a jury, however. And so.
You agree that there were, you know, sufficient expertise to link up perhaps or the of the prior convictions?
Absolutely not. We had overwhelming evidence in this case. We had the three exemplified copies of the judgments in the three priors, which all had the same name, date of birth, case. They cross-referenced each other in terms because a lot of the sentences were concurrent. We had a person with substantial experience in fingerprint examination who matched the fingerprints from the pen pack to the defendant's known fingerprints. We had the woman, the paralegal, who mainly just testified about her collection of the documents, and I believe all her testimony simply that was challenged here without any reference to any legal authority, I might add. Basically, all she testified was she'd, in her experience, she'd never seen a defendant have his DOC number changed amongst his different cases. And that's based on her personal experience. So I think the only expert we really had was the fingerprint, and she'd done thousands of examinations. In fact, I think she also talked about how she had her results peer-reviewed. And so I think there's just no question concerning the reliability or the admissibility of that expert testimony. Any further questions?
Problem that she wasn't certified?
She wasn't certified.
Counsel said.
I think her argument is wasn't, she wasn't qualified. I don't remember any argument as to whether she wasn't properly endorsed or anything like that.
Certified by some organization.
Oh, absolutely not. I think the cases talk about you can be an expert based purely on experience alone. And that's often what happens in these cases. You have either prosecution employees or police department employees that their whole job is to do fingerprint examinations. But certainly certification alone or lack of certification isn't sufficient to render it inadmissible. Any further questions? Nope.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Regarding the Melendez argument, which is in the habitual, it is a different argument than a straight Crawford argument. And it adopted, the Melendez-Diaz case adopted a Colorado Supreme Court case in finding what a definition of testimonial was and approving it. Pen packs are testimonial. Use of them without someone to confront violates the confrontation clause. And it is hearsay. The paralegal was not offered or tendered as an expert. She was not tendered as, she just came in and testified as a paralegal. Without an expert being tendered, you can't go into the broader base of a 702 analysis. Hearsay is hearsay, and that is exactly what the paralegal testified to. Hearsay. Those fingerprints, that's not my initials. But I know who made them. That's hearsay. And that's the whole essence of Melendez-Diaz. And that's why when you're doing this beyond a reasonable doubt,
Why is it hearsay to say that someone, to identify initials?
Unless you saw them writing the initials, and it's hearsay, because you don't have the person who did it saying, yes, these are my initials. It's evidence. And the same goes for the argument the court was asking about propensity. Everything they stated about the 404B, about the other burglaries, is propensity. He committed other burglaries, therefore he acted in conformity by committing these burglaries and having a TV. That's impermissible 404B.
Why isn't it he had stolen property from these three burglaries, and it's more an application of the doctrine of chances than anything else?
It goes back to what the trial court error was in this case, which is they did not require a specific evidentiary hypothesis. They let the whole litany in, and then the judge guessed at it, but that was, and then they had a severance again. It doesn't fit within that because it's not what he was charged with. He was charged with possessing stolen goods, not with having burgled a place, and he was tried as a burglar. And that's where the reversible error comes.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Arguments. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted. Continue issue in due course. The bailiff will announce a short recess while we reconstitute the court. Thank you.